So, hello and welcome to this afternoon session. My topic is talking about the SUSE security process. Myself, I'm Markus Meissner, I'm the team lead of the SUSE security team, working for SUSE and Novell since 2002, and actually working for the SUSE security team since the August of 2004. This is going to be on a not very deep technical level, but on a slightly technical level to help you understand how we work, what do we do as the security team, and what procedures and processes we follow. What I will not be talking about are specific security problems or security methods, only some of them will be mentioned briefly. So, my team's tasks are handling of the incidents, of the actual security incidents, like if a remote overflow is found, that we address the problem, that we find the problem, if it's not already known where it is, that we develop the patches and release the so-called updates. This is all inclusive incident handling. I will talk about this later in this talk. Then our work includes all the proactive work, like finding those security vulnerabilities or avoiding common security pitfalls. And it also includes design reviews. Last but not least is we also research new technologies on both the security problem side and also on the how to avoid security problems at all sites. You know that Novell is a pretty large company and has a lot of products, and that also might have security problems. My team especially focuses only on this Linux side of the Novell product lines. So the open source side of the Novell company. The other parts of security of Novell are handled by other teams. During our work, let me just mention that my team is just four people, and looking at the number of security updates we put out and the technologies we use, it's kind of impressive. But if you have to know that we are just one small part of the SUSE R&D department, so we are not actually doing all the work by ourselves, but we are helped by the normal packages, by the normal build system team, by the toolchain developers, by our QA department, by NTS, which is Novell Technical Support, who handles all the maintenance customer interactions, by the maintenance team that handles releasing and pushing out the patches itself. And of course, we are interacting with our customers who report security problems, who report problems with our updates to the security problems, because even we sometimes make mistakes, and various other folks. So, security work, what is it? There's sometimes the misconceptions that I want to clear up on this slide briefly. It's not cool. You see movies that are hackers that sit down on a computer, type in password or swordfish or something, and have root access to highly secret military installations. And all the girls love those guys. We are not good guys. It's also not really funny, because we see all the programs at their worst, when they crash, when they get exploited by evil attackers, and we have not really much to love during our daily work, because, well, if it breaks, it's really a sad event. It's not a happy event. And if someone manages to break an application, well, it's a success, but for us, well, if we break it, it's for us, it's more success, but we have to do all the aftermath. We have to fix it, we have to put out updates for it, and do disaster recovery on it. So it's also not much fun. It's sometimes a bit fun, but not really. And also, the work of my team, of any Linux security team, does not make you popular. if I walk around the office, visit any kind of office and look at the people, they are not just happy to see that, Marcus, what security problem I can help you to solve today? They say, Marcus, is something wrong? So they like to see me because I'm a nice colleague, but usually they think in their head, what problems have my package today? So it does not make me popular with the developers and also not with the project and product managers who come, I want this nice feature. The user must be able to log in without any password and he must have all rights. So this is of course not good. So we have to stop those, and they are not happy because they can't sell. It's totally easy for the user to do something because the same thing is also very easy for the remote attackers to do. So we can't allow this, we have to put a stop to this. So this means discussions, explanations, and in the end, well, the product managers and project managers are not happy with us, usually. It's also tiring work. A lot of the talks we had during this day and yesterday were about upcoming products and current development work, and all this development and product work starts at one point in time. They release the product, all is happy, and you just have to do some small cleanups. Unfortunately, the security work is not like this, because security problems happen every day, every week, every month. They don't stop happening. And even if the product is done, like if there's a CD or a box out, people celebrate. I'm just standing at the party and thinking, well, I have to take care of this product for 2 or 5 or 7 more years. So I'm not celebrating this product. I'm only celebrating when the product is finally discontinued and the announcement is published that we are no longer maintaining it. The problem is, 5 to 7 years is a very, very long time. So it's tiring for us. What is it? What I'm not mentioning here, because I just made a slide this morning, is that it's work that it's very responsible, that is so, and that is making someone feel that one did accomplish something at the end of the day, even if it's the same every day, that I fixed 2 security problems today, I fixed 3. It has not just negative sides, I want to say. So, before going deeply into our work itself, I will briefly mention what exact security problems happened over the time. The first ones that were known were buffer overflows, where you just overwrite a stack buffer and overwrite a return address and do some stuff, execute code and so on. It's actually known for 30 years, I think. Robert Morris was one of the first warm writers that used parts of this technique. And they have been investigated and understood pretty well, can be detected by modern software technologies like source code tools or source code review tools, or can be found or have already been found by manual audits. So they are pretty much in control, but still happen, unfortunately. The formant string problems, I will not go into details, it would be too technical now. They've been under control by using formant string checking that is available in GCC or in similar tools. So they've been mostly in check. Lately, in the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen a lot of integer overflows where you read an integer variable from the network, multiply it, add it, overflow its range of usually 32 bit, and then read into a buffer of that size that you got from that multiplication or addition, and then again you have a buffer overflow. So buffer overflows have struck back or string back and will continue to strike back because the scourge of integer overflows is not yet in control and there are no easy tools to find all of them. So it still happening regularly. The last 2 years specifically, I've seen a lot of problems with image processing libraries I think we've updated NetPVM, ImageMagick, and several others multiple times. Not to mention XPDF, which we updated well, 5 or 6 times. And we've seen a very, very increasing amount in web applications, namely in PHP applications and others. The problem with web applications in this regard is that SUSE itself is not shipping as much web applications as they exist outside. So usually you install our system, you install the PHP interpreter, some base PHP stuff, and then you download a PHP bulletin board, a content management system, or any other kind of PHP which has security problems, or might have, or as experience shows, usually has security problems. So if there's a security problem and we know, or we just don't know that our customers installed the software, so we can't help them with updates. So that's most of the problems that happen today happens in web applications, and it's pretty difficult for us. One idea would be to ship those applications, but looking at the development processes of those, we see that you have applications that are nice and cool, that are used for 2, 3, 4 years, and then the next cool application comes out, which has more, which is working better, or has more features, and people switch to those. This doesn't really align with our products. Life cycles that have like 2 years of maintenance of support for the box products, or 5 to 7 years of our enterprise server products. So we already now get complaints for our enterprise server product that it's 2 years old, that Tomcat, I think Tomcat was it, gets upgraded to the next major version. And we would get those requests much, much more for all the other web applications that we ship. So this is something that my team can't really handle because we don't ship those applications. This year we'll see more problems in web applications. Next year it will continue this way, and all those other things, of course, and several borderline other security problems that I'm not listing here. The general problem with the locally installed software that we see is also that more and more code and libraries and binaries take input from the internet, operate on code from the internet, and can so be exploited from the internet. Especially, I mentioned before the ImageMagick toolset and the NetPVM toolset. Before they were written for easy scripting of some local processes, now they are used in image gallery programs that are driven by PHP and similar things, where users can upload any kind of image data. And while the users 5 years ago didn't even consider that it might be called from a web app, now it suddenly is called from a web application. And suddenly it gets a more broader attack surface. And also what we are seeing, or what we are fearing, is that applications grow and grow and grow. One or two easy examples are OpenOffice and Firefox, or Mozilla in general. The problem with OpenOffice even is no one, I guess, has looked at the code yet. There are millions of lines of C++ code and C code inside, but no one has yet really taken a deeper look and trying to find all the buffer overflows and things that are inside. There was an update already in some MS Word Office document reader in OpenOffice, but I'm really fearing that there will be more problems. And Firefox has seen its huge number of incidents over the last 1.5 year, so this is going to continue to worry us in this regard. So, starting with our work, I will first talk about a known incident and a proactive, or so-called proactive work that we do. First, we audit security relevant packages, limiting ourselves due to resource constraints mostly to network, listening and system daemons, and security binaries, because those have the likeliest attack surfaces that remote attackers or local attackers could use. And especially you are looking at the specific network interface code, like the parts that read data from the network, or for security binaries, the argument and any kind of input handling. We look at the design of new technologies, like for instance DBus. DBus is an interesting thing because it's a completely new communication morphology that operates locally. Up to now we had calling programs or using Unix domain sockets. Now we have DBus, which can communicate across processes, and the user process can communicate with the root process. And this gives totally new local attack possibilities, because if I'm a desktop user and I can easily call a root process like hell or DBus daemon itself or PowerSafe or similar, then this service must also be secure enough over the DBus input to not be able to be exploited by local attackers. Fortunately, DBus is usually used only in local configurations. I've seen that it also can talk over TCP/IP, but this is luckily disabled. So we look at those new technologies to see if they have security implications. And of course, other security critical packages, like for instance, browsers or image libraries. We deploy automated measures to use our build system to pass compiler warnings, to check for permissions, for work-writable permissions or set your new root things, to spot if anyone has introduced those without notifying us first. We develop new technologies to, for instance, avoid security binaries. There is the REST Manager, daemon, and library toolset, which now at this time uses ACLs to give out device permissions to Dev Audio, to the Dev CD recorder, and the respective SCSI generic devices, and to the USB devices. So you don't need too broad file permissions on those, and you don't need security root binaries to control them or to write CDs, because any security root binary gives more attack surface. We also developed the SUSE Firewall, which is a light wrapper around the IP tables, NetFilter framework, and other things. We educate in that we write papers on, for instance, secure programming or on specific attack methods. And we hold lectures on security topics in general, like for instance this one. And we also do research into new technologies and new attack vectors. One of my team members is a doctorate, how's the English word? In computer science, whose topic actually is security vulnerabilities. So, this is only slightly related to our work, but we are making code harder to exploit, like we deploy the Fortify source extension to GCC and glibc to reduce the problems of stack buffer overflows. This is default enabled for all packages. We deployed the stack protector heuristic, stack overflow heuristics in 10.1 for selected packages. The hash structure validation to avoid the problems of hash overflows and mangling of pointers that live in dangerous areas, also for stack and hash overflows, have come from glibc developments in that area. Last but not least, we are randomizing the address space so that the attacker doesn't know any pointers to code. It can specify in its overwriting routines, which is deployed in 10.0 and 10.1 and the next products. We do automated code checkings like the already mentioned GCC warnings, and we also use third-party tools to look at the code. And in the end, we try to force or better teach people to write better code. by just asking, having them ask for reviews of their security critical code and telling them of their mistakes. I have to talk a bit about confinement here. I talked that the numbers of vulnerabilities grow, their applications grow, and so people, intelligent people, have designed kind of damage control called application confinement for the point in time when an attacker has broken into the application and is already executing code there. Usually you have already lost the system and need to reinstall it, because he can overwrite files or just start programs, run programs, hide them somewhere, and so on. So the idea to reduce this kind of intrusion is to limit the application's abilities to write files, to read files, or to execute programs, which already is helping, much, because if you can tell an application you are not allowed to execute anything, and you are only allowed to write to those files, those specific files, then you can only limit the damage an attacker can do in this regard. It doesn't really is an end solution or a final solution for this problem, but it also reduces the danger for a loss of integrity. Red Hat and the NSA and IBM develop solutions based on SE Linux, which is a very complicated and but nice and formal approach to a good problem, but it has a complicated configuration which a usually administrator without having long training sessions does not really understand, and it's also easy to make mistakes because of the complexity. So we have looked as well for other solutions and found a then called project called Subdomain, which is now called UpArmor by the Immunix, and bought this company to use this technology for application confinement and so to help our users. UpArmor access supplies access rich jurisdictions on the application level. So up to now, the user, if you were a user, you could do everything this user could do. This AppArmor toolset applies new mandatory access controls and applies restrictions on a per application basis. It confines file accesses, capabilities, and program starts. It adds config files, which are easily textual format files, are blobbing and wildcards possible. And it's you don't need to convert your whole system or your file systems or so to be level aware or to support SE Linux for every application. Actually, your application that you confine with UpArmor doesn't really need that it's confined, because it's the whole process is fully transparent to the application itself. So if you want to know about AppArmor, you shouldn't be sitting here, because Crispin Cohen is holding this talk on AppArmor in one of the larger rooms. But we have documentation and white papers on opensuse.org/AppArmor for further reading of this. The light version was on SUSE Linux 10.0. The 10.1 version will have a full featured version of it. So, before I start with the incident management or the incident handling, I have to briefly tell you about how much product lines we have. We have SUSE Linux, 2 years supported with security and bug fixes. Up to now, released every 6 months. Perhaps yesterday I heard it would be 8 months in the future. So we have always 4 to 5 product code lines of SUSE Linux active at every time. And our SUSE Linux Enterprise Server product, which has a 5 years version and 2 years extended maintenance, with longer release cycles between 1.5 years and 2 years. So where we have currently SNES 8, the Enterprise Server 9, the Desktop 1, the Desktop version 9, and the Open Enterprise Server. this is these are now 6 different products. There's the CES8 line, which SLD1 is based upon. There's the CES9 line, which NLD9 and OES are based upon. So these are only two major code streams. And soon we will have the SUSE Enterprise Server 10 and Enterprise Desktop 10, which is then the third major code line of the enterprise products. So in the end, we will have currently, I've counted currently, we have 5 different main code streams and soon 6, because the 9.1 box is also in the code stream of CES 9, and the 10.1 version will also be in the code stream of CES 10. So 6 different code streams are, however, difficult enough to navigate for security updates, because if you find a vulnerability, you usually have to update it for all affected ones. And if there are 5 or 6 different code streams, it's always a lot of work. So, how do we get knowledge of those incidents or of those problems? We read the public security mailing lists, Bugtrack, Full Disclosure, and several others. We monitor also closed forums for cross-coordinations between Linux and other free software vendors. We follow the new package releases for trigger words like security fix and so on. We of course do our own security audits, which I mentioned earlier. And we also take reports for our contact address security@suse.de. And what it's missing now, it's you can always also now open bug reports on our Waxilla and just assign it to the security team. We only track those that are not, that actually are in our products with their affected versions, and if they are in our products, if we are actually have versions that are affected, and if this is the case, we always open the Waxilla entry, so that we are not losing any kind of incident, that we don't lose sight of it, and that we can document when we don't want to fix it, why we don't want to fix it. So Waxilla is our main tracking tool in this. Yes?
Are the security reports in the Waxilla open or to some degree? Because the ones that are already public, we try to have create open, but all the others are closed. So you won't see them usually. We try to add them, we try to be a bit more transparent, but for security problems, understandable, it's a bit behind closed doors.
It's a common practice, I think, that security bugs reports are closed.
Yeah. But if you want to have more information on a released problem, then just write us, or then we can answer it. So we are always open for questions in this. So Waxilla, as said, is our incident tracking tool. We add all the necessary information that is useful for the actual bug fixer, like descriptions, if there are any IDs already assigned by cert or by Mitre to it. If we know it, the affected versions and products. If you already have patches, we add the patches. And if there are any sample exploits or point of POCs, proof of concepts, we add them so that our QA department can later check it. And we actually decide on whether we want to fix it for other products or not. Because there's a huge number of security problems, all of them have different impact on the system. Like if you can break in from a root, it's critical. If you can gain root access as a normal user, it's also critical. But if you have a 10-file vulnerability in a script that is run during a compile of a random KDE package, it's not really critical. And the normal user will not do this, will not run this, and would also do this on his development workstation. So a lot of, for instance, the temp-race exploits, which are not in the default system, and usually only happen at development system B, there will be further fixed for the next products. if at some later point the we get knowledge that it's actually more critical than we previously thought. We of course look back at the incident and revisit it to push it, but also release fixes if we consider it critical. Then we assign it to a packager in our R&D department, because we are not actually fixing the problems ourselves. We are just not enough people to do it. We assign it to the actual package maintainer. Henna already talked about it, and he's on the receiving end of all problems usually, not usually, but occasionally. And the packagers really like this. This is does not make us popular point again. Because we tell them we need this as soon as possible, and they have products, other products to make. Yeah. So we assign it to the packager because he has the knowledge of the package, and he can also contact the upstream maintainer for if he already knows about the problem and if he has a better fix for us or similar. We assist, however, with finding or creating patches if there are none yet. With the actual bug fixing, if there's really pressure on the package maintainer, and with the prioritization of the actual issues. Because this is sometimes not clearly visible for the package maintainer if this problem is more critical or has higher priority than this one. The package maintainer, he reviews our fixes, because even if we create patches, we might have made mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes, and the affected products, because we could have just determined the wrong set. He submits the fixed packages for the build system for all the affected trees, like usually then 5 or 6. Afterwards, the patches that are done are reviewed by yet another developer from the build system team. This multiple eyes approach is very helpful because we spot the mistakes early and not just later in QA or the fixes at the customer, because sometimes patches have broken functionality. This happened unfortunately, but usually such problems are spotted earlier. And this source level patch review is already is also is also required by the certification processes which we passed and which we would like to continue to pass. I will talk about the certification processes later. So the build system team member checks the package into these repositories. The build system itself, all automated scripts, runs the consistency checks during the build. Builds automatically all dependent packages of it, and we actually should check if all the dependent packages still build. For security fixes, where you have just very small contained fixes, they usually build, so there usually is no problem there. And one thing is that after the rebuild, we have not really bitwise the same binaries anymore for the dependent packages. So. But it's just this is just a side note. We can't release those packages that from our build system to the customer directly, because occasionally you have groups of RPMs that need to be updated at the same time. They usually need to be accompanied by a description and so on. So we have the concept of a patch set that will create the update structure for the customer. So there's a patch, there's a meta patch information file, which is accompanying the fixed packages up to the release of the patch. The root thing is tracked by our open source workflow management tool, which one of our students wrote for his diploma thesis called Swamp. It's available at SourceForge. Mm-hmm. The patch info file is created by the security team. Contains again what packages, what binary packages are affected, and no longer source patches. What distributions? It contains a description that you see in the REST online updater. It contains optional pre or post install messages available. And so you, like, you need to restart the service or you need to reboot the machine after update. And also links back for Bugzilla and Slog for the QA team. This also gets checked into our build system and then collects RPMs out of the current build system state and so fixates those RPMs for QA and later release. Then it gets handed over to yet another set of people, to our QA team, which are all also not popular. They use this created patch set to do exactly the same thing that a customer would do. Before it installs them, it checks the available exploits or proof of concept code if it is working, to just be sure that it's not working afterwards. And if there are no available proof of concepts, it asks the security team to develop one or any kind of indicator that the problem is there. Then they apply the patches like a customer would, either as online update or red carpet or ZLM for the respective products. Check if the dependencies are still okay, because this occasionally is a problem when we have to do version upgrades for security updates. It also checks the component integration by running the test cases we have for those packages and to recheck that the exploit no longer works and the proof of concept no longer works. If anything of those fails, it gets handed back right to the package maintainer and to us for actually really fixing the problem or the resulting failures of this update. So, last slide of our incident handling. We are not releasing before the coordinated disclosure date. This is a process called responsible disclosure. So we coordinate release dates between the Linux and BSD and other software vendors, which usually, if the problem is not known, is 1 week or 2 weeks ahead, but not much more. So the vendors have a chance to prepare updates and run it through the QA I just told you about. We wait for QA approval. So even a remote root exploit must pass QA before we release it, because otherwise it would violate not just our process, but also might break on the customer side. The technical things happen when we approve it is that the patch is copied to the infrastructure, our mirror infrastructure, the same way as for the QA team. So we are getting the same packages and the same new patch information files. There are no further manual steps, so if you press the button, it gets out to the customers without any possibility to stop it. It's possible to stop it, but without any other human being able to delay it further. And then all the technical support people review the support documentation that is generated for the enterprise products. And in the end, we release the security advisory with the information, with the IDs and some more detailed comments on this. So, finishing up my talk, I would like to ask from you that you install the security updates. Sometimes people are afraid of doing so please don't be afraid, please install them, it really helps. If you see strange crashes in applications, like when you open a certain website, the browser crashes all the same at the same point, then likely crashes could also be security problems. So report the crash to the actual package maintainer, like for Firefox it would be Mozilla, or if you don't know who to report to, report it to us. And very important, if you have servers, monitor your servers. Because I know a lot of people that bought a root server or some kind of web server in a big hosting farm, they put SUSE on it or whatever the provider had, and when they put it on the website and then they forget about it. They use the website, they do stuff on this website like using a forum or so, but they never look back at what actually is on this machine. And if it's not a good provider, then no security updates are installed and no one is looking at the log files and no one is even seeing that there are attackers on this machine after exploiting some remote problem. So if you have your, if you have servers, deploy usually monitoring software to check if the updates are installed and if it's not infected by attackers. If you are a developer, program safely, okay, easy set, but difficult done. Use perhaps better languages. I will briefly tell them about right now. And use always think about security when designing your software. All those are there are lots of books available for those topics, and I really recommend reading some of them at least. Before I come to the languages, just some words about the certification. For us, in general, security is not just a feature that's on a box with a check mark behind it, but a process which we follow, or my team, and the SUSE RD follows all the time. Certifications in the sense of the government common criteria certifications describe configurations which profiles how users act, how attackers act, the versions of installed software, the common of configurations for the hardware, and also the processes. So the security handling that we do during the lifetime and the documentation of all the processes and also sometimes the low-level processes and also the physical security at the development areas. And what in the end comes out of this is a so-called common criteria, common access protection profile, C/CApp at evaluation assurance level, for instance, 3+ or 4+, which usually is just a lot of paperwork, but also in that it describes all the processes and all the reviews that needs to be done is also a good thing. We are following this. So, just some more languages. C, we all know, has a lot of potential for buffer overflows. So, also a lot of potential for speed. So that's why people use it a lot and love it. It's C++. If you use C++ with a template library like STL or Qt, then and use their string classes and their user buffer management classes, then it already reduces the risk of all those buffer overflows and similar. You can also use managed languages and environments. Java, you all know, unfortunately not very common in the usually application development space. C Sharp coming up, but not yet really there at this time. And also the script languages, which have their own problems because they evaluate input, and might use of script languages sometimes might introduce more problems than you have had before. But some problems like buffer overflows are not possible in Perl, for instance. It's not also not in PHP, but PHP itself has different problems because of argument escaping and similar. So choose your language wisely when programming. Likely try not use C, or use C only with very careful string operations. And try to, yeah.
Yeah, with C, there is a fortify source option.
Yes, yeah, I mentioned it earlier.
You mentioned it earlier, sorry.
And yeah, it helps a bit. It helps you, but in the end, if you do buffer management in C and you program it yourself, you are likely to break it in a way that fortify source is not catching it either. So, if you need to use C, perhaps one can recommend using glib2. Okay, it's a GNOME library, but actually it's not really a GNOME library. It's a low level. It's more low level than GNOME. Yeah, but it has string operators. It has string handling, and which is more safe than just using strict copy or so. So, with this, I'm finished with my talk, so if you have any questions, please ask them now. Yes?
Yeah, what kind of third-party tools do you use for code checking?
Up to now, we are using mostly Grep and our own eyes. There are some others which we always want to use, but have not yet deployed them. So, it's, yeah. More questions? Yes.
How well are we handling security in combination with the new packages that we will be having with the new SUSE build system? Basically, everyone can build packages now. Then.
There are two things. We have been opening up our distribution, so you see what is happening inside the SUSE stable tree or the factory tree all the time. For those, we have changed the rules that security fixes that are not yet public only get checked in when they get public. This is one problem. And the other problem about the build service is, this is something that we have to still look into. Usually the idea would be to refer this to the package maintainer of the actual project or the package that is used there. But it's something that definitely needs to be, that we definitely will address it at this point. If you have thousands of people there, not thousands, but dozens of people uploading their projects, and there needs to be people that also look at this. It can be either us, the security team, or we invite, I think, for this also the help from the external people that report bugs for those projects or those packages that have problems to the actual maintainers that might also be external users. So we'll see how it works out, because there's a lot of community interaction which just needs to be established in this regard. More questions? Okay, then I thank you for listening, and I will hand over to Stefan.